This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're into employment law. We're focusing on the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll be referring to it probably as the ADA. We'll also be talking about the Fair Employment and Housing Act, which is the California law, perhaps which has greater protections for employees in the workplace. And so that's what we're focusing on. My guests are employment law attorneys Lisa Lawson of the San Francisco law firm of Pennington Lawson, and she's a member of the executive committee of the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, which, by the way, has funded this program for, I think, at least 20 years. My second guest is Phil Horowitz, whose office is in San Francisco. Phil is a past chair of the Labor and Employment Law section and also a past chair of the California Employment Lawyers Association. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chuck.
For someone who's not done a radio program before, you seem very cool.
Oh, well, I'm glad I appear that way.
You must be very good.
I'm a wreck inside.
You must be very good in court. Is that right?
Well, I'd like to think so, yes.
Okay. And Phil, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Phil has been on the program several times. Phil principally represents employees. Lisa principally represents businesses or employers, occasionally employees. Am I right there?
That's true. I describe it as representing companies and executives.
Okay. All right. So let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about what we better do, because I think most people have heard of the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, which is the federal law. What about the Fair Employment and Housing Act, Phil? What is that, and how significant is it in California?
Well, the Fair Employment and Housing Act is the state law that prohibits employment discrimination and also prohibits discrimination in housing. It not only protects people with disabilities, but it protects people against discrimination because of gender, sexual orientation, race, national origin, religion, and other categories as well.
When you represent an employee who you feel is being discriminated against by his or her employer, do you also include in your complaint allegations under the ADA as well as the FEHA, the Fair Employment and Housing Act, or just one or the other?
Usually I only allege allegations under the California Fair Employment and Housing Act. It provides greater protections to employees. And if you add an allegation under the ADA, it gives the employer the power to move the case to federal court, which is often considered more protective of employers than state court.
Really?
Indeed.
Really?
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, it's called removal jurisdiction.
Anytime, no. But why would the federal court be more protective of employers?
Well, the judges tend to be more conservative. Also, when you get to juries in civil cases, including employment cases, you need to get a unanimous verdict of 6-person jury in federal court. Oh. In state court, you only have to convince 9 out of 12 jurors to win. Yeah.
Okay. I got you. That I did not know, because of course I haven't had any employment law cases. All right. So what would you say, if you would give us some ideas to help all of us who are listening to you, what's a disability? How do we generally describe what a disability is? What does it mean?
So, Chuck, if you try to bring it down to layman's terms, it's basically a physical or mental impairment that makes performance of a major life activity more difficult. And a major life activity are things such as walking, talking, seeing, hearing, and working is also considered a major life activity. So if you have some type of impairment that makes achieving those things more difficult, it could be considered a disability.
Let me throw something out to you. I've been in contact, not in my job, pardon me, as a deputy DA for San Mateo County, but when I've gone shopping at a major supermarket, and one of the employees, very nice cashier, has a back problem. And I learned about this very recently, and when she doesn't have people, customers coming to the cashier's stand where she is, because of the pain in her back, there's a little stool in the cashier area there that she can sit on. And apparently she feels that the manager of the store is kind of giving her not comfortable looks when she does this. And I said to her, although I'm certainly not an employment law attorney, I said to her, you know, in my opinion, the company needs to accommodate you. Because she said to me before I said that, she said, I wish I had a chair to sit on. And by that, I think she was talking about a chair that not a regular chair like you sit at a dining table, but like a stool, for example, something higher up that would make it easier for her. And I said, I think that probably the company here has the obligation to do that. I'd appreciate if you would respond and tell me, am I totally wrong? Or is there some basis for her being accommodated?
Well, Chuck, I think you're correct that the company is required to accommodate her. Certainly when she's not serving customers, there doesn't sound like there's any reason at all why she couldn't sit down mm-hmm. and have something with good back support mm-hmm. for her back. That certainly would be a requirement. There are not only the anti-discrimination and reasonable accommodation laws here, though. There's a California law that says that employers, to the extent feasible, must give employees chairs to sit in rather than just require them to stand all day. Now, there are a couple of pending cases that have been brought under that about cashiers. One case has said that cashiers are required to be given chairs to sit in as long as they like, that they can sit in while they're serving customers. There's another case that's come out the other way, mm-hmm. saying that standing, being closer to eye level with the customer and so forth is an essential function of the job. Mm-hmm. And so it's not feasible for the employer to be required to do that.
These are decisions that have been rendered by different appellate courts in the state of California, I assume.
I think they're still at the trial level.
Oh, they are?
Yes, because it's a fairly new
one. Haven't gotten to the Court of Appeal?
Not yet.
Okay. So it's going to take quite some time before we finally get that resolved.
A couple of years at least.
At least, yeah. And the reason that I bring this up is that when this woman, who I see on a very regular basis when I go to this supermarket, when she mentioned that she had a back problem, she said, I probably will not be here much longer. And I said, why? And she said, well, I've got this back pain, and I just am having real problems. And that's how it all came about, that she's after. And I said, well, how long have you been here? 8 years. And so I felt, and she's not very old. And I felt, gee, that doesn't seem right. So, okay, well, thank you very much. I will communicate that to her when I hear her, see her. I have asked her to listen to this program. I hope she is. What about this? If someone has a disability of some nature that makes it difficult for them to properly perform their job, what is the employer's obligation to give the employee time off? And if there is an obligation, how much time off?
Well, that's a good question. It's one that I get all the time. It really depends on the circumstances. So, first of all, an employer is only obligated to provide a reasonable accommodation to a disability, and you have to first determine if time off is actually a reasonable accommodation. Mm-hmm. And whether it is in one person's situation may be true and yet not true for another person. And then how much time off is a reasonable accommodation also varies depending on the circumstances. You know, there aren't a lot of hard and fast rules mm-hmm. under FEHA and ADA. There is a notion that you cannot, as an employer, have leave policies that put a finite period on leave regardless of whether the employee is still disabled and in need of an accommodation. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's very difficult to come up with any hard and fast rules in terms of how much time off is enough and mm-hmm. whether it's reasonable in that particular situation.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you know, it's all an individual thing depending on what your disability is, of course.
Well, there is one baseline, and yes. that is that you're entitled under two additional laws to at least 120 days off for a disability and also for pregnancy. That mm-hmm. those laws, the federal laws, the Family Medical Leave Act, mm-hmm. often known as the FMLA, the state law is called, we call it CFRA, which is the California California Family Rights Act. So that's the baseline. And the question of how long an employer has to accommodate depends in part on how interchangeable the person is. Mm-hmm. Let's say that there's 50 people doing the same job and it's easy enough to shuffle around. That employer may be required to give that person leave for a year, 2 years, 3 years, because there's no hardship.
Not paid leave, though.
No, unpaid leave.
Unpaid leave, but with the right to come back when you're ready.
To the same job, with no retaliation.
Okay, well, that's good to know. All right. You mentioned something before we went on the air, that there is another significant area, aside from disability, where religion, that there has to be an accommodation by the employer if one of the employees has some kind of religious, either wearing a particular type of thing or perhaps celebrating a certain type of religious event. Phil, could you talk briefly about that?
Sure. There are only two types of protected categories where employers have to go further than just treat people the same. One is people with disabilities, and the other is honoring people's religious practices. Mm-hmm. So an employer is required to reasonably accommodate religious practices, such as giving days off for the Sabbath, unless it creates a undue hardship, whether the Sabbath be Saturday or Sunday. And then a new law was just passed in California going into effect just January 1st, so just a couple of weeks ago, that makes it very clear that employers in California are required to reasonably accommodate religious dress and grooming practices, which would include beards, it would include head coverings, and furthermore, not only must they allow those, but they cannot take those employees and shuffle them in the back and remove them from public contact. Mm. The idea is that we're all people and should be just...
Is that going to be challenged?
No.
That law, do you think that is going to be able... We're not going to have big problems with that?
I think that that's solid. I don't see anything that could be done to challenge that.
I'm glad to hear that. That's good. There is something called the interactive process. What is the interactive process and how does an employee benefit from it?
Right. So the interactive process flows from the employer's obligation to provide a reasonable accommodation. Once the employer becomes aware in some way, whether it's because the employee has told the employer or it's become apparent to the employer in some other way, the employer then has a duty to provide a reasonable accommodation. How the employer and the employee go about determining what is that reasonable accommodation is through the interactive process. So it's this label that we give to the exchange that an employer and an employee go through in order to arrive at what are the limitations that the employee has, what are the specific limitations that the employee has regarding performing their job, and what are the accommodations that the employer could provide, and which one is most suitable.
And who does the employee then, generally speaking, who does then the employee deal with if the employee wants to be involved in an interactive process?
They typically deal with somebody from human resources.
I see.
If it's a medium-sized company. If it's smaller company, then somebody else in management.
Going back, if you don't mind, to the cashier I'm talking about in a major supermarket, if she wanted to be involved with an interactive process, what would she do? Or is that appropriate for her in this situation?
Absolutely. She should start either verbally, just by talking with her supervisor or human resources. She might want to send it in an email or some way where it's documented to help protect her against retaliation. Mm. And just do a simple letter, just down earth, not legalistic or anything, saying, I've got a bad back. It's hurting me. It stops me from doing a lot of major day-to-day life activities. And, I really need something to be done to allow me to do my job. Let's talk. I think maybe a chair, maybe a few minutes off each hour. But let's talk and work something out so I can keep working here. I'm a loyal employee. Please help.
Well, that sounds like that's the approach to take, and most employees don't know that that's what they should do. All right. I'm going to give you the phone number. We have kind of set the groundwork for you. If you'd like to call in and speak with my guests, it's 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. If you have a question, a comment, or some problem at your place of work, whether you are the employee or the employer. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guests are Phil Horowitz, who's been a great supporter of this program over many, many years. Phil is a past chair of the Labor and Employment Law Section, also a past chair of the California Employment Lawyers Association. My other guest is Lisa Lawson. This is Lisa's first time on the program. She's a member of the Executive Committee of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, which is one of the major funders of this program. And I understand that we have Ellen on the line. Ellen, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, Chuck. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you and Mr. Horowitz could touch a little bit on a cumulative disability where you have one, you file for one injury, and then over a course of time, other parts of, in my case, my back gets affected, which in turn causes other problems. How does that work? I mean, is there a point where they can terminate me because of an accumulative, or say they can't find any other work for me?
Ellen, let me ask you a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
With respect to the initial injury to your back, and now it's advancing to other areas, has this all been while you've been at the same employer, or have you changed employment?
No, it's been the same employer, injury.
Don't go away. I want to, because my guests may have some questions for you, but let me see if I can get some comments for you. By the way, please understand this, everyone. My guests are experts in this area of employment. They're expert employment lawyers, and also in this area of Americans with Disabilities Act and the Fair Employment and Housing Act. But the State Bar does not permit them to give specific legal advice. So as we talk about this situation, please understand that my guests are trying to give you direction of what may be available to you. And probably at that point, you need to contact your own lawyer. So with that in mind, Ellen, stay on the line. Let me get some comments from starting with Phil.
Sure. Employers are required to reasonably accommodate disabilities. And it's not at all, unfortunately, uncommon that someone has one disability and in turn it causes something else to be disabled and causes further repercussions. Employers are required to accommodate reasonably all of those things. So the question becomes, with reasonable accommodation, that's reasonable in the sense that it does not impose an undue hardship on the employer, can you still perform the essential functions of your job, is the first question. The second question is, if not, is there a vacant position to which there's no one else who has legal rights to, for example, under a union seniority system that you can perform, that's not a promotion, with reasonable accommodation. And if that's not so, then you may be entitled to a leave of absence. The hard part oftentimes is deciding what are the essential functions of a job. Is it a minor part of the job? Is it how much of the time is it done? What, you know, could the job be split? Could someone else help with the job parts that are harder? And then the next hardest part is to determine whether it's an undue hardship for the employer. Mm-hmm. That you have to look at a lot of factors. How large is the employer? How prosperous is it? How many other people do this job? How much trouble would it be to move things around? If it's a large enough employer, they may have to go quite far in accommodating.
Ellen, I don't want you to tell us who the employer is,
but
have you seen an attorney at all, an employment law attorney yet?
Yes.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you have any kind of procedure going on at this point or not?
No, I do, and mm-hmm. it's been settled.
Oh, it has? Okay.
It has been settled, but because now my doctor cannot attend the other injuries that I have, whether it be my shoulder, my back, other parts of my body, they cannot take care of those parts because it's not part of the claim.
It sounds to me like maybe you have a workers' compensation claim. Is that right?
That's correct.
Oh, okay. That's a little bit different than what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. You'd have to consult another or the same workers' compensation lawyer, and it may be that the settlement includes the subsequent injuries that seem to have been triggered by the first, or it may be that it does not, in which case you could file an additional workers' compensation claim. I don't do workers' compensation law. It's a whole other area, but you should pretty quickly talk to your same or a new workers' compensation lawyer to get advice, because there may be fairly short deadlines to
file a claim. Have you been represented by a workers' compensation attorney, Ellen?
Yes.
You have?
Workers' compensation, disability.
Yeah, okay, all right.
But in the long term, would that turn over to becoming a disability, a permanent disability?
Well, if it's something that prevents you from doing major life activities, you know, walking, mm-hmm. moving, mm-hmm. Comfortably doing the sort of things that other folks do, and it makes it more difficult for you to do them or make some of them not possible, then we do label it a disability. It does not mean that you can't do anything. All it means is that something is harder for you to do because of, you know, this physical issue you've got going on. And whatever rights you have under workers' compensation laws, in addition to those, you also have the right, one, not to be discriminated against, that is to say, treated worse because of your disability, and two, the employer still, regardless of the settlement, has an obligation to reasonably accommodate your disability. There's some good cases out there saying that settlement of a workers' compensation case normally does not take away from you the right to make claims for disability discrimination or failure to reasonably accommodate.
Ellen, let me tell you something that you might want to do next week. We're doing next week our regular Call a Lawyer night, which we normally do the fourth Wednesday of the month. And I will have with us both a workers' compensation attorney in the conference room here at KALW, as well as a disability attorney, employment law attorney. He does both of these. He was my guest last week, Peter Sturges. And so I think what you might want to do, if you like, is listen to the program, or at least call next week. Call a Lawyer starts at 7 o'clock, as I start the regular program at 7 o'clock. You can call in 1-800-525-9917. I suggest you do this, and maybe you'll get a few more pointers on what your next step may be. And we're going to move on because we've got a lot of people.
I appreciate that. Yes, I do. Thank you, Chuck.
Okay, you're welcome. You're welcome, Ellen.
I appreciate your time.
Good luck to you. Happy New Year to you. Bye-bye. Thanks for calling. Now, this is kind of unusual, and this has not happened. The next caller is Ellen, but it's spelled differently. E-L-L-Y-N. Ellen, welcome.
Hello.
I don't know if somebody's playing games with us or not, but you got a chance to call in. What may we do for you?
Well, I am actually self-employed. And my question has to do with I have an office, and I'm wondering if the landlord has any obligation to make some adjustments. They've encouraged me to move to a different suite. And because of my back disability, I use only the sink that's at kitchen counter height, and I can't use the very low sinks that are in the bathroom and the other rooms of the suite.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also benefit from having the lever kind of doorknobs rather, lever kind of door openers rather than the round knobs. I have made accommodations for my disability with the fixtures that I provide, but mm-hmm. these are the permanent fixtures. And I wondered if the landlord had any obligation to me as a disabled person to make those changes, particularly if I agree to move to another suite for their benefit.
And are you saying, Ellen, that there is another suite that would accommodate the difficulties you've mentioned to
us? There's another suite that lacks the accommodations that I currently have. And they would like me to move in there, and I explained that I would need accommodations for me.
Well, let me make sure I understand this. In the suite you are currently in, is it set up in such a way that you...
It's set up in such a way that I have access to a sink I can use.
Oh, I see. Okay.
In this suite, there is only one door that has a handicap accessible door handle.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is raising questions about what duty does the landlord have to accommodate somebody who is, ironically, this is a medical office building, so it could be...
Wouldn't you know it?
It could be construed to also include the people who come to the office building.
Sure, of course. You have a lease with your landlord, do you?
Yes, I do.
Do you for how long a period?
It runs until April of 2014.
Okay, all right. Let me get some comments from my guests. Who would like to start with this?
Well, I'll be quick. It's a very different area of the law. Oftentimes people think it's the same. There is a notion, or there's law under the ADA that requires businesses to make their places, you know, accessible to the public.
And if spending is over a certain amount, they have to make those changes. I'm familiar with that.
But I'll defer to Phil, because it's really not an area that I practice in.
Phil, do you know anything about this?
Well, I don't practice in it either, but the Americans with Disability Act does require some accommodations to make, places that are, to be accessible. So you should consult an attorney who can give you advice. There's always the question of whether it's an undue hardship for the landlord. But in the situation you're in, it wouldn't seem to me like it would be.
Ellen, let me mention something to you. Where are you, by the way? What city do you work in?
San Francisco.
Okay. At the San Francisco Bar Association, you might want to get in touch with Carol Conn, C-O-N-N. Last year, I think I did two programs on the ADA and the responsibility of a business to the public, for example, in accommodating members of the public to come into the business. It may be that you call the San Francisco Bar, tell them that you listen to your legal rights, because the San Francisco Bar is one of the funders of this program, and ask to speak to Carol Conn, and hopefully she may be able to give you a reference to an attorney who is familiar with this area. I know that we did a couple of, I thought, very effective programs with the guests that Carol gathered together for me. So did you write her name down?
Yes, I did.
Okay, very good.
Thanks so much.
Hey, good luck to you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And by the way, we will... another thing, Ellen, next week when we do Call a Lawyer Night... Peter Sturgis also is involved with disabilities and the disability law. You may want to also talk to him off the air at 800-525-9917. All right, I think, we have just about run out of time. It is about, goodness gracious, I'm just going over here. It's 729, just about 729 at 91.7 KALW in San Francisco. You're local public radio station. If you would like to talk with my guests, it's 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. And this is Your Legal Rights. If you've tuned in the last few minutes, we're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act, the protections that it affords in the workplace, as well as the Fair Employment and Housing Act, which is the California law, which also provides protections for employees in the workplace. And what I want to let you know about is that I just mentioned to Ellen, of course, calling the San Francisco Bar, but if you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. And Ellen, what I would like you to do is don't just call lawyer referral, call the main number of the bar. You're going to have to look it up and ask to speak to Carol Conn, C-O-N-N. I think that's the best way for you to deal with that. And just tell her that Chuck Finney suggested you call. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own. And of course, during business hours, normal business hours, 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced and set you up for a half an hour consultation with the attorney, usually face-to-face. Although if you do have a disability, I think usually bar associations will try to accommodate you and have a telephone interview for you with the attorney. And depending on what county it is, for half an hour, it could be a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. It's a fine service. So in any event, I want you to know who my guests are. And they're both very experienced persons in the area of employment law. Phil Horowitz, whose office is in San Francisco. He's a past chair of the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, also a past chair of the California Employment Lawyers Association. My other guest is Lisa Lawson of the San Francisco law firm of Pennington Lawson, and she's a member of the executive committee of the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, which is the funder of this particular program today. So let me see who we've got. We've got Linda. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Well, I don't have any. I don't want to talk about disability, but I just would like to ask you. I work for a big corporation, and I have a supervisor that is going around and writing up some people, giving them verbal warnings, and other people who do the same thing. They're not getting verbal warnings, and I want to know what I can do about that. What are my rights about that if she writes up a certain amount of people but not the other people that are doing the same exact thing?
Writes them up for what? What kind of things?
I really can't say, because then it's going to, you know, it's something that they did wrong on their job. Well, obviously.
So you're saying the supervisor writes up certain persons for doing something wrong, but doesn't write up other persons who are doing the same wrong thing.
Correct.
Is that right?
Right.
And you work for a major corporation?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, let me get some comments for you. Can she take your answer off the air? In other words, turning the radio back up? Can she hang up her phone?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Hang up your phone, Linda, and listen to the answer on your radio, would you?
Okay, I'm going to hang up the phone.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you very much for calling.
All right. Well, this is called disparate treatment in law, and that means treating different people in the same situation differently. The first thing you look at is to see whether there is some contractual right to be treated the same. Mm-hmm. If someone's represented by a union, it may say that you can't be written up without good cause, and part of that is that people similarly situated in the same sort of situation have to be treated the same. Some large corporations, but not many anymore, give that sort of protection even without a union, but that's awfully rare. Without some sort of what we call contractual duty that the employer has, the next question is, are people being treated differently for some reason that's prohibited by law? So if the people who are being written up are being written up because they're disabled, mm-hmm. or because they're women and women are treated less favorably in a particular job, mm-hmm. or their race, or their age, or other protected characteristics, or because they complained about unlawful conduct or conduct they reasonably thought was unlawful, then it would be unlawful. Mm-hmm. Unless one of those two things is true, you've got a jerky employer, but no legal protections, unfortunately, from my perspective. Mm.
Any comments from you,
I'd
Lisa?
I'd have to add that the discrimination laws prohibit employers from treating people differently because of protected characteristics in terms of the terms and conditions of their employment. So clearly employers can't fire people for reasons that are protected under the law. Whether simply writing somebody up and putting a note in a personnel file rises to the level of discrimination because it affects the term and condition of employment is not necessarily a given.
Well, all right. What would you suggest that Linda do at this point? What should her next step be in light of what she's concerned about?
There's the low-risk approach, and there's the higher-risk approach.
All right. What's the low-risk approach? Forget it and don't do anything?
yes, and or look for greener pastures elsewhere.
Yeah, which is difficult in today's market.
Unfortunately, it sure is.
Yeah.
The higher risk approach is to bring it to someone's attention and ask for help. The reason it's higher risk is because all too often employers target people who complain about things.
And retaliate.
They do.
And fire them.
They do.
Now, that though, could be an unlawful termination, could it not?
It's only unlawful under California and federal law if the person's what they're complaining about is unlawful. In other words, if this is discriminatory or you know, because someone was a whistleblower, but if it's just because the company or some of the supervisors are acting like jerks, there's no protection.
All right. Linda, if Linda hung up, and I think hopefully she listened to this. I certainly think that you should have a conference with an attorney, whether it's through the lawyer referral service. I can't remember if you're working in San Francisco or not, but whatever county you're working in, you probably should contact the lawyer referral service for that county bar association and try to set up at least a half an hour consultation with an attorney who represents employees. Would you agree?
Yes.
Okay. All right. The number 1-415-841-4134. Gabriel, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Good evening. Thanks Hi. For having me.
Of course. Turn your radio down, would you?
My radio down, I'm sorry.
Yeah, because there's an echo. It's like we're in the Grand Canyon. Go ahead.
About 10 years ago, I was quite young at the time. My mother went to the hospital. She had a psychotic break. And she was in the hospital for about a week and a half. At the time, of course, the entire family was kind of shaken, didn't really know what happened. Anyway, it's always been a curiosity to me. What is there any sort of, once she returns during her absence, is obviously a mystery. And what sort of interactive process would she have or could she have engaged with? Would there be privacy? What sort of accommodations would be available to someone, not necessarily who just had psychosis, she subsequently didn't have anything else, still she was shaken, there was trauma, it was difficult. What sort of things are there for these sort of mental health fiascos, really?
Well, mental disabilities are treated the same as physical disabilities under the law. So the obligations that we've already spoken about to reasonably accommodate and engage in the interactive process would still apply to any type of mental disability.
Okay, and then the next question is, what sort of accommodations does the person need? Mm-hmm. So people with who've just gone through a major psychological breakdown, the first accommodation normally needed is time off for treatment. The second may be time off on a you know, once a week or twice a week or three times a week for office visits with a psychiatrist or a psychologist. The next thing you look at, is there anything about the job that the person can no longer do or needs to be changed? Mm-hmm. There have been cases, for example, where there's an abusive supervisor. Mm-hmm. And right. Whether or not that's what triggered it, a transfer to another job with a more mild-mannered, shall we say, supervisor is a reasonable accommodation. There can be situations where someone's got a psychological condition where it's difficult for them to interact with many members of the public. So there may be an open, vacant position to which no one else has a legal entitlement to, such as under a union seniority contract, to which a transfer might make sense. At times, an extended leave of absence might be a reasonable accommodation. One important thing is that the person does not have to disclose what their condition is. Sometimes, especially with psychological conditions, people are very reluctant to let that be known to the employer. All they've got to disclose is what the limitations are. So, for example, it may be that someone can only work half-time for a while. It may be that they cannot be interacting with members of the public who are potentially hostile, for example, if they're a bill collector or something. Mm-hmm. So all they've got to do is have to disclose what the limitations are. It's helpful to have a doctor put those limitations in writing. If it's anticipated that it will be for a limited period of time, it's helpful to let the employer know, because it lets the employer know that whatever additional work or money they need to spend to make this happen will be for a limited time period. Mm-hmm. And then you go back and forth between the employer and the employee, mm-hmm. and try to find something that will allow the employee to keep doing their same job with changes if needed, or if not, find another job, mm-hmm. or if not, see whether a longer leave of absence would be appropriate.
Does that give you some ideas of how you might deal with this, Gabriel?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's in the past. My main concern would be obviously the stigma, and clearly if there isn't a need to disclose the conditions, it limits what happens. Obviously, there's a mystery, and those sort of things obviously can't really be dealt with definitely. But yeah, absolutely. I didn't know really anything about it, so I was going to ask you. I really appreciate your thoughts.
Okay, and there's one additional point. When the person discloses something about a medical condition, whether it be the nature or general nature of it, or simply the limitations, which is all they're required to disclose, the employer owes a duty to keep that information confidential. Mm-hmm. There's a federal law called HIPAA. And there are other federal laws as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's not information that should be spread around. Yeah. If the person feels more comfortable, they might go directly to human resources and ask to speak, you know, just to one person, make sure they make it clear that this is confidential information. It's not to be spread around. It's not to be the subject of rumors. And only the people in management, human resources, or medical consultants of the employer with a true need to know should learn that information.
We're going to move on. Good luck to you, Gabriel, and your mother, okay? Thank you very much for calling. Marianne, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Marianne, are you there? Hello, I guess we lost Marianne. All right, I think we have Ariana. Ariana, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, sure can.
Okay, thank you. So I have a foot injury that's been about 3 years going, getting worse, but I might be able to get better from it. I'm just laying that as the background. But currently I can't walk very much or stand very much. So I have two questions based on that, and I think they'll be interesting to probably a lot of your audience. One is just about applying for disability. I think that I considered that, started to look into it, but I believe it said something about you had to have worked. I haven't worked in 4 years because I've been in graduate school. And I thought there was something that you had to have worked in order to be eligible for disability. So the first question is, like, just sort of if you're, the lawyers could run down the eligibility for disability. And also, I did call a disability rights agency, and they said it takes about 2 years. You always get denied the first time, and you have to get a lawyer. It just sounded like this huge, long process, and I can't wait 2 years to have some income. I really need some income now. Which, if you don't mind, leads me to my second question, which is about applying for jobs. And, you know, once they find out about my foot injury, wouldn't they just pick someone who doesn't have, you know, any injury that they would worry about or deal with?
Very good point.
In other words, they can't be sued for discriminating because I'm not hired yet. But, you know, it's sort of discrimination in jobs.
Yeah, Ariana, let's get some comments for you if you'll turn your radio back up so you can listen to it. Thank you very much for your call. Let me do this. Before we start in your response to Mariana, let me just mention to you that the San Mateo County Law Library is having tomorrow, that's Thursday, January 17th at noon, a Basics of Estate Planning. And attorney Julie Lanz, L-A-N-Z, will be giving a noontime lecture at the Law Library. And it's free, open to the public. And if you're interested, you can call and get more information tomorrow morning at 650-353-4913, 650-353-4913. And that is tomorrow, January 17th at noon. You can bring your bag lunch if you like. It's the San Mateo County Law Library across the street from the Hall of Justice in Redwood City, and the address is 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. All right, how about responding to Ariana? Who wants to start?
Well, I'll start with her second question, since that is in more within my area of expertise than the first. The notion that the employer has to reasonably accommodate an employee also applies to applicants for employment. Mm-hmm. And so to her question, if she presents with a disability that would seem to preclude her from performing the essential functions of the job, the employer still is obligated to provide an accommodation even though the person is not yet hired. And if she applies for the job and she's equally qualified or more qualified than somebody else without the foot injury, the mm-hmm. employer cannot use the disability to in the selection process of the other employee. In terms of the state requirements for applying for disability insurance, I just don't have any mm-hmm. expertise mm-hmm. in that area.
Okay. Phil, do you have any comments?
As far as disability income, first of all, normally you can only get disability insurance of any sort if you're unable to perform any sort of available job that's widely available in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And our caller sounded like she could do a whole variety of different types of jobs. Mm-hmm. That being said, there are at least three different programs that could provide potential income because of her disability. One would be if she happened to have private disability insurance. Mm-hmm. It sounds like that's not the case. Mm-hmm. The second is the California State Disability Insurance. That does typically require that you have recently worked and for a certain period of time. I don't do that area of law. I can't give you all the details, but there's that available, and you could look on their website. It will give the specifics. And the third is Social Security. In addition to mm-hmm. providing retirement income, it provides for disability income for people who have been disabled. I think it's for at least a year from working. Mm-hmm. But they have to have paid into the system for at least a certain period mm-hmm. of time. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't clear from our caller yes. if she'd done that. That long. But as far as looking for work, I mean, there are a lot of employers who are more than happy to hire people with some sort of disabilities. The caller sounded smart, motivated, educated. So just go out there with a good attitude. Tell them how excited you are about getting a good job and how you'll work hard. And, you know, it sounds like someone, if I had an appropriate opening, I'd want to hire.
All right. We've got Julie. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Chuck. I was wondering if you could just explain the difference between SSI and SSDI.
Hmm.
SSI is Social Security Insurance, and that's retirement income when you're, say, 62 or 65, or in some cases, if you are married to someone who passes away who was eligible, you can get that as well. SSDI is Social Security Disability Insurance, and that applies to folks who are not old enough to qualify for Social Security retirement benefits, but who have gotten a permanent or long-term disability that's lasted at least, I believe it's a year.
Mm-hmm.
There's information on the federal website.
Sorry, is that means tested?
No, it is not means tested. It's completely independent of any means. There is supplemental disability insurance available that is means tested, but that provides a greater level of income.
Julie, welcome. Well, thank you for calling and good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. All right. I hope I pronounced this correct. Is it Habti?
Yes, right, sir.
Habti, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have a question. I worked for a security company almost 9, 8 years, and then I'm disabled with diabetes, arthritis, gout, which I do my job without any accommodation, whatever it is. But my accommodation was, the timing and the food which I have supposed to eat, all this stuff. And the company, the first time they come, they took my glucose meter without notice me. And then they denied the doctor note, which he wrote he cannot work after midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the morning, they denied, and then I collapsed. They put me in the morning to, I get off 12 midnight and to come back 8 o'clock. I collapsed at work.
Mm-hmm.
And then I filed to EEOC, all this, but it's almost now the next March. Will be maybe expired. What should I do in this situation? And during my break time, they told me not to leave the facility, not to go anywhere to eat. And then I suffer for this all stress. And then I apply for my own job, which I have experienced 8 years. They denied that you are old enough to do this kind of stuff.
Hapti, let me stop you. You have so many problems here. Have you seen a lawyer at all about this?
No.
Why not? Why have you not?
Well, I'm not that type of person. You know, I'm 61 years old. I have just 4 years to go and then to retire. That's what my plan is, you know, but I try to beg them with a letter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me, Hapti, let me ask you to stop. Let me get some comments for you. In what community do you work?
San Francisco.
Okay. Let me suggest to you, and my guest or guests will have some comments for you, but I think it's really important that you take advantage of this fine program that the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco has and go see a lawyer for at least half an hour and try to get some help. Would you like to jot down the number?
Sure, I will.
I mean, you know, what I try to do on this program is get people to be somewhat active in trying to help themselves instead of being inactive. And I think you need to give yourself a little kick in the you-know-where to move in the right direction. It seems to me that, you know, you could get some help, but you've been reluctant to do it. And so I'm going to give you the phone number for the Lawyer Referral Service for the Bar Association of San Francisco, and I hope you call to try to get an interview with an employment law attorney who represents employees and try to, for half an hour, and you're going to pay $35. I mean, that's a pretty reasonable charge. Are you ready to write?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, 415-989-1616.
1616.
And if you will turn your radio back up, my guest or guests will give you some comments and try to give you some direction of what to do. Thank you very much for calling, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Phil, what thoughts do you have for Hapti?
Well, there's
lots of thoughts.
Where do you start?
Okay, well, we've got disability discrimination.
Yeah.
We've got age discrimination. We may have retaliation for opposing discrimination.
Yeah.
And we also have a failure to give meal breaks, which is a completely additional right.
Yeah.
First of all, employers have to give you a break, for a meal break every 4 hours or at worst every 6 hours. And during that time, they've got to relieve you completely of your duties. You've got to be allowed to leave the premises.
Mm-hmm.
And even if there's some bizarre or very unusual situation where you can't, for example, there's a clean room environment, you'd have to de-suit and re-suit, they must allow you to eat food. Now, if you have a situation such as a disability like diabetes where you need to eat food on a pretty regular basis, I think any employer would be required to reasonably accommodate that by allowing a 5, 10, 15-minute break to eat food even every hour or two as necessary. The second accommodation required was only working certain hours, for example, not having too short a break between shifts. Whether or not that's a reasonable accommodation as a security officer would depend on the situation. You'd have to look at the employer, how big they are, whether there are other people who could handle that shift, whether they could hire someone additional and have them be a part-time relief person. I would think, unless it's a very small company, that would be a reasonable accommodation, not posing undue hardship, but you'd have to look at it further. And as far as age discrimination, mm-hmm. you can't tell someone or do it even if you don't tell them, say, you're too old at age 61 to work. You can't say that to someone who's 80. But you have to make an individualized assessment of whether or not the person can perform the duties with reasonable accommodation. And as far as seeing a lawyer, please see a lawyer.
Yeah.
People, it's the last resort. No one likes to see a lawyer, or most people don't. It's the last thing they want to do, just like most of us don't want to go to the dentist. But if the tooth hurts enough, you go to that dentist. And if you're suffering enough from a legal wrong done to you, go to a lawyer.
Hapti, please go to a lawyer. You need to do that. All right, this will be our last call. Greg, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. A question that may be a little bit more generic than just the subject that you're on tonight. But if you mentioned something about a letter written regarding a disability, if somebody's trying to either alert or notify an employer or in any situation where a disability may be involved, I am disabled, and I found at times that I thought my doctors put in too much information. Mm. I thought that it wasn't necessary, and I think for some of the reasons you've already mentioned, people want that kind of information to be relatively private, and therefore I'm assuming that a doctor doesn't have to go into extensive discussion about the disability in order to alert an employer or anyone else, for that matter, who might be involved in a disability situation about the condition that the disabled person has. The other thing I'm wondering, too, is this. If an employer enters into some kind of an agreement with a person, and this could apply to other disability situations, too, and they either violate or fail to fulfill the terms of the agreement that they've reached, the reasonable accommodation, what recourse do people have?
Let me get some comments for you, Greg. Turn your radio back up. Thank you very much for calling. Briefly, what can you tell, Greg, at this point?
To go back to the issue with the doctor providing too much information, some doctors are not as sophisticated as others. Many of them are aware that they shouldn't be disclosing the details of the disability, but sometimes what you need to do is have a conversation with your doctor and apprise them that all you need from them or all you need to substantiate with your employer is what the limitations of the job are. And so, unfortunately, the cat's already out of the bag, I guess. As Phil said, there are HIPAA requirements that require the employer to keep that information confidential going forward. And I'll let Phil respond to the remainder.
Anything, Phil, further to have for Greg?
Well, but that's about it. I mean, you know, it shouldn't be spread around the workplace, and they've got to do reasonable accommodations. You should talk with the doctor and look at the note before it goes out.
Well, I thank you both very much for being on the program with us and giving us this very fine information about ADA and the FEHA. My guests have been employment law attorneys, very experienced, Lisa Lawson, a member of the Executive Committee of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, and Phil Horowitz, past chair of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar and past chair of the California Employment Lawyers Association. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you on the program. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California, by the Trusts and Estate Section of the State Bar, by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, by the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and by the San Mateo County Bar Association. By the way, next week is Call a Lawyer Night, where you'll have a chance to call in, ask a question, make a comment if you like. With our off-the-air attorneys by 1-800-525-9917. On the air, we're going to be talking about prevention of elder abuse. My guests will be certified specialists in estate planning, Linda Kramer and Deborah Kramer-Raden. Thank you very much for listening to this program. I'm Chuck Finney.